This time, Ron Atkinson's West Brom Pioneers, 78-81.
And it's no nay never, no nay never no more, cause I'll stay a while to over, forever and more. And it's no nay never, no nay never no more, cause I'll stay.
Hello and welcome to By Far the Greatest Team, a podcast in which football fans debate the ultimate question, just who is the greatest team of all? My name's Graham Dunn. Normally at this point, I would make a comment about crowbarring in an Oxford United reference where they don't belong. Last week, I managed to get a reference in a story about Diego Maradona, Argentina and Napoli. I'm not going to have a problem with Ron Atkinson and West Bromwich Albion. That is not going to be an issue, I can assure you. And joining me as ever is a man still reeling from the shock of me outsmarting him on a data issue in last week's pod. It's Jamie Rooney.
Yeah, I mean, I need to rethink what I'm doing. I'm going to be smarting again because I was lined up for my intro to get the Oxford United reference in before you, but you've gone and done it straight away. It's like you got me at the very beginning. I thought I was in for early doors. I'm like, I'm going to get him on this one with Ron Atkinson. But I mean, you even beat me to that. I mean, I'm just not having a good time right now.
It's an absolute winner. So this week we've got a fantastic team, and it's a team I wanted to do really right from the outset of the podcast, because even though they didn't win anything, it's a side that just has this huge impact. It was right at the start of my watching a football, and I just absolutely love this West Brom story, and they are pioneers in so many different ways, far beyond actually just what I thought. I'm delighted we have somebody who knows the West Brom story far better than me. Welcome, Ian Ward.
Hello there, guys. Thanks ever so much, Graham. Hi, Jamie. What a wonderful introduction. Yes, but just like you, Graham, that great West Bromwich Albion team under Ron Atkinson, my first footballing love, to be honest with you, and a lifelong love. What a wonderful team. I was a teenager at the time, believe it or not. About 16, I was still at school. Just a great time. And I think those kind of times, it could be football, it could be music. Such an important time in your life. That football team is pivotal in my memory. And will, for me, I can't imagine I'll ever see a better West Bromwich Albion team. It was just a wonderful time. Ron Atkinson was a very flamboyant manager, as you've alluded to, Graham. Played for many years for Oxford United. Does he hold the record appearances? I'm not sure if he holds a record league appearances.
Record appearances. Ron the Tank Atkinson.
Brilliant stuff. I was only thinking, because I've got John Shuker in the back of my head, but obviously you'd know better than me that perhaps John Shuker played the most league games, but does Ron Atkinson have played the most games altogether? But of course he had his brother, Graham Atkinson, who I think, did he hold the record or still does for the most goals scored for Oxford?
He still holds the record for most goals for Oxford, a record that he wouldn't hold if James Constable's hat trick against Chester City hadn't been scrubbed off when Chester went into that is it. Graham Atkinson is the goal scoring record. Ron Atkinson was 500 odd games for Oxford, and a question I have, because I came unstuck on a previous podcast where I hadn't fully appreciated that Nottingham Forest like to be called Nottingham Forest rather than Notts Forest. As a Baggies man, is it so? What's the WBA, West Brom? The Baggies, West Bromwich Albion in full, is there a sort of preference?
I think for a lot of fans, it would be the Baggies. I think the official, I know the official nickname is the Frossels.
Oh, of course it is, yes.
You don't hear anybody say that these days. But of course, you've got the Frossel on the badge. And I don't know if you're aware of this, guys. It apparently came about when Albion got the Hawthorns, and that opened in 1900. When they bought the land, there were some hawthorn bushes, hence the Hawthorns. And some of the rumours were that there was a song thrush, and I think I put it in a cage from these hawthorn bushes. So I don't know how true that is. But no, I think the fans would refer to, you know, come on you Baggies. I've never heard anyone for probably about 40 years say, come on you Frossels. But and West Bromwich Albion. No, I think it'd be the Baggies or the Albion. Yeah, sorry, going back to Ron Atkinson. Again, I'm probably telling you guys what you already know. He started his managerial career as a player manager at Kettering Town and did very well. And he soon got picked up by Cambridge United, where he really cut his teeth. And in the fourth division, as it was then. And again, he did very well. The character that everyone knows, and I dare say loves really, Ron Atkinson. Very outgoing, very cavalier, extravagant. I mean, just to give you an example, when he was at Cambridge as manager, he was driving a 4.2 white Jag at the time, which, not the done thing in you know, Division 4, as it was, circles at the time. In fact, there's a great story that Ron tells. He'd been lined up to get the West Bromwich Albion job, and he'd already agreed terms and all the rest of it. But he had to go through the formality of a formal interview at the Albion with the board of directors. But bearing in mind, he'd already got the job. It was just a tick box exercise. So he's sitting at the Hawthorns outside the boardroom waiting to be called in when a director at the time was walking past him in the corridor, a guy called Sid Lucas. And he calls him over his finger, gesturing towards the window. Ron, come and have a look at this. And Sid Lucas was proudly showing him. He said, this is your company car. This is what you're going to get at the Albion. And it was a 3.6 Jag. And he says to Ron, look how good that is. And I don't think Ron Atkinson had the heart to say to him, it was actually a downgrade on what he was getting. Well, he was driving around in Cambridge. But I think that's just a measure of how extravagant. And his first signing, obviously, when he joined the Albion, he went back into Cambridge to pick up Brendan Batson. Brendan Batson's got an interesting backstory. He came to the UK when he was age 9 from the West Indies. He'd never seen a football before until he came to England. But obviously, he quickly took to football and he joined Arsenal. He signed pro for them when he was 17, the first black player to play for Arsenal. But it didn't work out terribly well. I think he played about 10 games or thereabouts. And funny enough, when Ron Atkinson went in to get him from Cambridge as his first signing, West Bromwich Albion, Ron Atkinson had a fullback, Paddy Mulligan. Mm. And having watched him in training for a couple of weeks, Ron Atkinson's thinking to himself, hang on a minute, there's a guy back in the fourth division at Cambridge I think's better than this guy. I'm going to go and get him. Now, back at Cambridge, there was a guy that looked after all the transfer dealings, was a tough negotiator. But Ron Atkinson knew that this guy wouldn't be around the club on a Wednesday afternoon. This guy would always go off to play golf. And also, he had a lady friend that he would go and visit after his golf. So Ron Atkinson waits till Wednesday afternoon, phones the club to speak to this guy, to be told he wasn't there. He knew damn well he wasn't going to be there. So he gets put through to the chairman. The chairman of the club is more of an accountant, not so much on the playing side, more on the books. And Ron Atkinson says, I want Batman, because that's what he called Brendan Batson, Batman. He says, I'll give you 25 grand. And the chairman goes, come on, Ron. We both know he's worth 10 times that. Ron Atkinson said, 25 grand, take it or leave it. Put the phone down. I think about an hour or so later, the chairman's phoned up. Yeah, come on in, Ron, let's sort it. Anyway, Ron Atkinson was determined to get the deal done and dusted that afternoon. So he phoned up Brendan Batson, get down, got him all signed, and it was all sorted out. The following morning, the guy that looked after the deals from Cambridge was on the phone. So I can't say on air what he was saying to him, but he wasn't very happy that Ron had sorted the deal out. And Ron said, well, I tried to get hold of you. But that was the kind of thing that went on in those days. So I was just going to say, Brendan Batson, he made his debut for the Albion at St Andrews. And Paddy Mulligan's in the dressing room beforehand, going round to all the players, wishing them luck. And he came up to Brendan Batson and says, I hope you have a terrible game. And the rest of the dressing room are falling round laughing. But Brendan Batson was a bit worried. You know, I don't think he liked it, really. And as it happened, Brendan Batson went out. This is at St Andrews. And he tripped on a banana skin, believe it or not. As he's going out. And he actually had a dreadful game, unfortunately, for Brendan, for his debut. Albion managed to win, but he didn't play well at all. Then he had his second game, which I think was against Ipswich Town, from memory. And again, he had a poor game. His third game for the Albion was against Everton at home at the Hawthorns. At the time, Brendan Batson was staying at the Europa Lodge Hotel, which is where the players used to stay. And on the morning of the game, he went to have his breakfast in the hotel. And Ron Atkinson had come down Ron Atkinson didn't say a word to him, just sat next to him and said, "It's now or never, Batman." So Brendan Batson knew he had to play well because he couldn't afford three bad games, else he'd be out of the team. As it happened, he played very, very well and he kept his place and, you know, the rest is history. But it goes to show, if he'd have had a poor game, who knows, the three degrees and it could have been a completely different story.
It's really interesting because Brendan Batson actually is a player who, and certainly out of the 3 degrees that they were called for, right or wrong, Brendan Batson was probably the least well known of them, or probably the least heralded of them. But Jeremy, you were watching that game, a couple of West Brom games ahead of this, and he's a real athlete, wasn't he?
Yeah, I just love watching him. I sadly don't remember Brendan Batson. I'm just a little bit on the fringe of not remembering him. So I think my points of reference is of watching YouTube videos. And yeah, I mean, I absolutely fell in love with him as a player almost immediately watching some of the clips. I mean, the clips aren't focused on Batson as a player, but he's very present. And what I loved about him was that he's playing it right back and he's got a real grace to his game. His head's up, his shoulders are back, he's looking ahead of him. He can go left, he can go right. He'll cut inside with the ball. He would support an attack, so he'd come into midfield. You know, everything you get... We're talking about modern day fullbacks. I think you've got it right there in the scene of, you know, Brendan Batson. He looked an absolute. It's interesting hearing Ian talk about his first two games for the Baggies because it's not what I've seen. What I've seen of Brendan Batson, I just thought he was a quality player. And it's no surprise that he won the Player of the Year when he was at Cambridge in the fourth division. I think he then won it in the third division. So he's clearly too good for the lower divisions. And it's no surprise, really.
On
and he competes in the top flight.
Yeah, it's spot on. And also, as Graham said, it was very much, I'm loath to say overshadowed, but that's probably the truth, if a little bit harsh, by Cyril Regis and Laurie Cunningham. I mean, Laurie Cunningham, what a footballer. Ron Atkinson used to say he wouldn't leave footprints in the snow. He was such a graceful, skillful, extremely good footballer. And in that season, probably Albion's best season, that 1978-1979 team, where Albion fans, certainly of my generation, would say Albion should have won the league that year, in my humble opinion. Laurie Cunningham, we played Valencia over two legs in the UEFA Cup, and particularly the first game away in Valencia, you finished 1-1, but Albion played really, really well. And that was the night Real Madrid made their mind up about Laurie Cunningham. They're going to come and buy him. I don't know if you've ever seen, guys, on YouTube, the famous game over Christmas in that 1978 when West Brom won 5-3 at Old Trafford. I don't know if you remember, you pick up, and Gerald Sinstad, the commentator at the time, commented, because all the booing when Laurie Cunningham got the ball. And I'm not trying to castigate Manchester United fans, to be fair, because it was the same all over. There wasn't a club that acted any differently. They tended to win over the fans. There was another game that season. We played Leeds United at Elland Road and we won 3-1 in the league. Now, Leeds United and West Brom, they've got quite a checkered history with the fans. I think you probably covered it on a previous podcast, the famous non-offside goal involving Ray Tinkler. And I don't think the Leeds fans have ever forgiven West Bromwich Albion for that, because... I mean, that season when Bertie Mee's Arsenal won the league and the FA Cup to do the double, Arsenal picked Leeds to the title by 1 point, literally 1 point. Now, although in that particular season, Leeds lost 5 games and drawn 10, I think, they still blame West Bromwich Albion for costing them that league. Basically saying was that the Leeds United in that 78-79 team, Albion went to Welland Road and the 3 degrees players were getting dogs abuse from the fans. Absolutely terrible. At the end of the game, Albion had won 3-1. Cyril Regis got 2. And the other goal was Tony Brown. Just very quickly, the goal Tony Brown scored that day actually took him in front of Ronnie Allen to become Albion's record league goal scorer that particular day. But the other two goals were scored by Cyril Regis. But as the players are coming off the pitch, the Albion players were like, gesturing to the Leeds fans, 3 fingers on one hand and 1 finger on the other one. But to their credit, the Leeds United fans stood and gave them a standing ovation. And I don't think that happens too often at Elland Road. It certainly in that particular era? Because it's hard for people to think back now, you know, having three black players on the pitch. It seems crazy talking now in 2024. But of course, back then, they were groundbreaking. And it's hard to overstate that.
Yeah, I mean, it is extraordinary. And when you think back, and actually, you know, Laurie Cunningham, the first black player to be recognised at England level, I think it was under 21s, wasn't it? Cunningham and Brendan Batson are two of the first three. I think Viv Anderson's probably the first, isn't it? But two of the first three black players to be capped at full international level. It is extraordinary that it's a thing. I mean, it seems unbelievable, unbelievable now. But it's almost extraordinary how, I mean, West Brom were kind of able to turn it into almost like a marketing thing, weren't they?
Yeah, it's a strange one, really, because I'm not sure if that was a conscious thing, but we also had the Three Degrees, the pop group, of course, and that certainly became a marketing thing. So I remember we played Everton at home in that season, and just for the record, LB won 1-0, but the the Three Degrees actually appeared on the football pitch at halftime. Now, I was 16, I might have just turned 17 at the time. I had no real idea who the Three Degrees were. I mean, for all I know, that could have been a group from Tipton or Dudley. Or it was only years later I thought, oh, this is an international pop group, you know, from Philadelphia. And it's bizarre.
What did they make of being at the Hawthorns?
I really don't know. It's strange because at the time they were promoting an album called New Dimensions, just checking it up here. Produced by Giorgio Moroder. Now, do you remember Giorgio Moroder?
Yeah.
He produced a lot of, I think they called him the godfather of disco, if I remember right.
He produced
a lot of the Donna Summer records.
I think he's involved in Phil Oakey Together in Electric Dreams as well.
That's absolutely right. Yes, you've got. I like your style, Graham.
You promised we'd go down some rabbit holes, so I'm definitely glad we have.
Oh, absolutely. But just for the record, I mean, I don't know if you're aware of these guys. I mean, obviously the Three Degrees have always been a trio. I mean, pretty odd, really, if you call the Three Degrees and not be Oscar. I just presume that the three singers had always remained constant, but I think there's been 16 different singers. but the Three Degrees that were at the Albion, I think, were the real deal. You've probably seen the wonderful photo.
Yeah.
But apparently, I didn't realise till years after the event, I don't think either Cyril, Brendan or Laurie were particularly comfortable with those photos because obviously they've probably got girlfriends and wives themselves. And I think a lot of people assumed that there was like relationships. Of course they were. And also I think Laurie, Cyril and Brendan were a bit worried how it's going to be perceived by the rest of the dressing room. You know, were these three black players getting all the attention? And obviously it was a very, very good side. I mean, Cyril Regis, I haven't spoke about him, have I? Wonderful player, playing for Hayes in non-league. He was spotted by Ronnie Allen, who's a legend in West Bromwich Albion circles from the 1950s. He was chief scout for the Albion at the time. He saw Cyril Regis, went to the board and said, "You've got to sign this guy." But Hayes wanted £5,000, which sounds ridiculous now. But the Albion board were balking at it. They didn't want to pay £5,000. And I think they're only persuaded to do so when Ronnie Allen said, "Well, if you don't, I'll pay it out of my own pocket." He was that determined to get him. You know, the best £5,000 Albion ever spent, I think, getting Cyril Regis. Yeah, and I was a bit spoiled, tell you the truth, as a 16, 17-year-old, because I thought this was going to be the West Bromwich Albion I'd support for the rest of my life. Winning games. I mean, Manchester United, for example, I think from the season we got promoted under Johnny Giles, I think I'm right in saying we probably played them 8 or 9 times in the league. And we only, at the Hawthorns this is, and they only ever beat us once. I think 3 seasons, we beat them 4-0, 4-0, 3-1 at home. So I would go to the Hawthorns on the bus as a teenager, playing Manchester United. And I honestly expected us to beat them. Sorry, I keep saying us, West Brom to beat them, which sounds crazy now.
Well, it doesn't sound so crazy now with Man United where they are, but yeah. Of course, one of those was the 4-0, which featured the fantastic Ali Robertson handball off the goal line, which was
Yes.
Which you've spoken about before, which is a thing of absolute beauty. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. I think he gets booked for it, but Jamie, you were watching you were watching a game where Brian Robson produces something almost as special.
Yeah, it's going forward a couple of seasons beyond this point. It's, I think it's the 79-80 season, and West Brom go to Anfield to play Liverpool. And on this particular occasion, sadly, they're roundly beaten 4-0. But at the time when it's goalless, a cross comes in. David Fairclough lands a brilliant header, and Godden, the goalkeeper, is way out of shape. Robson's already kind of see where it's going to, so he's kind of backpedaled. And then he produces this incredible left-handed diving save to tip it over the bar. It's an absolutely wonderful save, and any goalkeeper would be proud of it. Referee awards a penalty, no card. It's just... There should be no double jeopardy when it comes to handballs in the box. The penalty is sufficient. No, it's a brilliant save from Ryan Robson. Yeah.
It's incredible when you think back. But, of course, in those days, you only had one substitute, didn't you? The players were all numbered 1 to 12. It was very, very simple. You never had a substitute goalkeeper on the bench. And I think a number of these outfield players fancied themselves as goalkeepers. I mean, Tony Brown, for example, he was the designated standing goalkeeper, if you like, should the goalkeeper of the day, typically Tony Godden in these days, but before that it had been John Osborne. In the event of an injury, Tony Brown would go in goal.
I love that. I love that category of outfield players playing in goal. Unbelievably, you think it was consigned to the history, Oxford playing in the highly esteemed Bristol Street Motors Trophy last night. Keeper sent off after having made all five of our subs. We've made five subs and still... So Oisin Smith, outfield player, went in goal for the last 5 minutes or so. I mean, if I could make one rule change in football, it is to ban having substitute goalkeepers on the bench.
I completely agree.
I couldn't agree more.
If only to give us the opportunity for that Alvin Martin statistic to be matched. Alvin Martin scoring his only hat trick against three different goalkeepers, as Graham's very proud of that stat that we brought up in previous episodes.
That's an incredible stat. Justifiably proud, Graham.
Yeah. Talking about Ronnie Allen, he obviously was manager before Ron Atkinson. Not for a very long period, but it was him who brought Cyril Regis in. Is he perhaps a bit under-recognised in his part with this team?
A little bit jaundiced, because although he was a wonderful, wonderful footballer for West Brom, the truth of the matter is he wasn't terribly liked by the players, unfortunately. Prior to him being manager, so we had Johnny Giles.
Yeah.
The players absolutely loved Johnny Giles, absolutely loved him. He could relate to them. They could see him on the pitch. He was a leader on the pitch.
Yeah.
So the players really bought into Johnny Giles. When Johnny Giles moved on, Ronnie Allen came in. Different era. I should have said, before Ron Atkinson took over, Ronnie Allen got a lucrative offer, I think, to be like an advisor for the Saudi Arabian national team. Some things never change, do they? So off he went to get the oil money. But he eventually came back to manage the Albion for a second time. And rather bizarrely, the Albion had narrowed it down to two. Ronnie Allen and Alan Mullery. The board had agreed Alan Mullery, but there was some breakdown in communication. I don't know exactly what happened to this day, but Ronnie Allen ended up being offered the contract by mistake. I don't know if it's just a clerical error. So we signed the contract and it was too late. But the stories are that when the West Brom players found out that it was Ronnie Allen, they just couldn't believe it. Alistair Brown, for example, used to share a room with Brendan Batson on away trips. Alistair Brown was playing in the US at the time. Do you remember they used to go off and earn some money in the summer playing in America?
Yeah.
And when he heard the news that Ronnie Allen had been put in charge, he apparently phoned Brendan Batson. And he kept saying on the phone, tell me it's not true, tell me not true. This was all in days of just landlines, no mobiles. And Brendan Batson, like, well, sorry, who's talking? Tell me it's not true, tell me it's not true. So that was, I don't think he was terribly highly regarded by the players, unfortunately. But just like Johnny Giles, the players really loved and responded to Ron Atkinson.
Mm.
Ron Atkinson used to like joining in the training. Ron Atkinson still, because when he was manager at Cambridge, apparently he thought he was the best crosser of the ball. even though he's the manager, you know, he could take the best free kicks, he could take the best penalty. And Brendan Batten in his autobiography says, we used to sit there thinking, come on, we hope you miss you. We hope you miss. And he said he would never would. He would ping it right in the top corner. But, of course, when he got to the Albion, he was no longer the best. He loved to join in and always got a smile on his face, always got an amusing quip. The training was interesting. So the players really loved it.
Yeah, so let's get into the this, because this is an extraordinary thing, and when we're talking about West Brom as a pioneering team, so they are the first English football team to go to China.
Absolutely, yeah, and as you say, how bizarre and random is that? Yep, because what happened was, Chairman Tsitsong had died in 1976, and China was trying to improve its relations, if you like, with the West. And bring down the bamboo curtain, for those old enough to remember. And although West Brom were the first English team, I think New York Cosmos had travelled there the previous year as part of Pelé's world retirement-type tour. But what happened was, the plan was the England national team were going to go on this tour of China. I think Don Revie might have arranged it. Could have been part of altitude training in preparation for the World Cup in 1978 in Argentina. But, of course, England didn't even qualify for that World Cup, unfortunately. And Don Revie had moved on. And Ron Greenwood took over as England manager. Ron Greenwood didn't fancy taking an England team out there. And Albion's chairman at the time was Bert Milicic, who obviously became Sir Bert Milicic.
Of course, okay. So he was the FA chairman, wasn't he?
He was subsequently, but he wasn't at the time when the China tour came about. I think he was in the corridors of power there, but he hadn't quite reached the chairman. But I think he probably saw this as an opportunity to not do his chances of promotion to that role any harm at all. So he said, yeah, I'll take a team out there. It was a very important tour in terms of diplomacy. Mm. In fact, I think the West Brom players were given like a program or a menu of things that they could and couldn't say, and they had to be on their best behaviour at all times. You see, footballers in that generation, if they went away on a club trip abroad, they would normally be, you know, go to a Spanish hotel and sit by the pool, have a few beers, a card skull. That's what they were looking for. This trip to China was anything but that. And I think they just found it incredible, because what you've got to think back to at the time, it's almost akin these days to someone going to North Korea.
Yeah.
It was an area of the world that nobody was aware of or had seen. It was a very, I'm not sure if secretive is the right word, but it was an alien country. And, of course, it was very dark over there. Everyone wore the same, those like military style outfits that they wore, and obviously all on bicycles. Yeah, incredible. I think they had a very long trip out there.
Really, I was reading about that, which did seem a bit of a nightmare. So it seems to be the obvious routing of Hong Kong via Rome, Bahrain, Calcutta, then arriving in Guangzhou, and then a train ride, presumably from Hong Kong to Guangzhou. Of course, that's how you get across the border. And then another flight to Beijing.
Sounds to me, Graham, that you're listening around the world in 80 hours, Phileas Fogg there. I mean, it's pretty much recreating Jules Verne's journey for Phileas Fogg.
Brilliant. But you probably remember, guys, because it was so groundbreaking, the BBC Centre film crew, headed up by Julian Pettifer, I think it was The World About Us, to follow the Albion and to see how it went and how the locals reacted, etc. But you've got to understand, these are just ordinary working class kind of guys, these footballers, going out there. And it was just so different to what they'd envisaged. I mean, a number of the players embraced this and thought, yeah, we're going to see something we'd probably never, ever see again, and really enjoyed it. There were others that just didn't appreciate it at all. And perhaps only in retrospect, look back and think they could have done things differently.
I think it's definitely...
You're probably going to mention the Great Wall of China.
John Trezeguet, what a comment. But I think just clearly with this particular team, we're talking about groundbreaking moments. And having a documentary crew from the BBC going out to China isn't massively groundbreaking because there were football documentaries before that. But I mean, this is something pretty new. And, you know, if you look at what we get now with the Welcome to Wrexham and the whole kind of the Amazon Prime All or Nothing series, they've become
yes.
This is a bit of an unusual one. And, you know, Graham and I love a football documentary. Our favourite one is Escape to Victory. We love that one. But what is
yeah, it's a documentary. It is a documentary.
What do you mean? Because it's. You've already alluded to it. I've only been able to sample snippets, and I'd love to watch the full documentary. But it's the cultural differences that the players reference. It's quite incredible. They talk about, you know, the people of Peking. They don't even call it Beijing. Peking are all dressed in the same clothes. There's thousands of bicycles, and there's two fascinating things. There's one bizarre thing actually. You've probably seen the same clip as me. They go to a show, and in the show, there's a ringmaster and there's a circle. And going around in the circle is a giant panda sat down in a pram playing a trumpet whilst an elf is around in circles. It's, you know, for a cultural kind of like indoctrination into something that's completely different to what you used to, it's absolutely brilliant and how the players respond to that. But one of the things that really stands out is when they actually play a game, the discipline that they can't make any noise. They all comment on the bizarreness of that.
No, you're absolutely right, because I think they played one game against the Chinese national side in Peking. And I think that the attendance was 90,000. But the players said that you could hear a pin drop. Because as you rightly mentioned, Jamie, I think they've got numerous reminders over the tannoy not to cheer, not to applaud. Because I think in Chinese circles at that time or in their culture, it was deemed very impolite to do so. So the players just found it very, very weird and eerie. I mean, you could legitimately seem there, you know, like you're playing in front of in a library. You know what I mean? Because that's what it must have seemed like.
It's only fair that you probably should, you know, share the John Trezick comment.
John Trezick. What a... Yeah.
Well, that was very, very unfortunate, I think, for John Tucker Trezick, another ex-Oxford United man, of course, Graham.
Very much so.
Yeah, because I think he was caught a little bit, because he said that as a joke.
Mm.
But, of course, it's been taken, because what he actually said, for those who are not familiar, when the players had gone out to look at the Great Wall of China, he happened to comment, "When you've seen one wall, you've seen them all, haven't you?" But he was just saying that as a joke. But the way it was edited, it came across he was being serious. Mick Martin, he'd actually quipped, "I've been free kicks around bigger walls than this one." but they didn't pick up on that one. But no, that's, Jack Taylor accompanied the squad, and he refereed the games out there. You're probably aware, just for the record, Albion played 5 matches for what it's worth. Not surprising that they won them all, because I don't think China's ever regarded itself as a major footballing power. I mean, Ron Atkinson famously said it was the 3 weeks going on 10 years. That's how he felt the trip. I think he couldn't wait to get back home.
Amazingly, I was reading this. It's a great article Simon Burnton in The Guardian has on this. He interviews Brendan Batson and a couple of people. But amazingly, within a couple of months, they then end up in Aleppo in Syria playing a pre-season friendly there.
Absolutely bizarre. Yeah, you're absolutely right. They went over there and played 2 games after in Damascus. And incredible. But the strange thing was, you know, Ron Atkinson wouldn't go. I think the China trip was such that he sent his assistant to take the team, Colin Addison.
Sorry, just on Ron Atkinson, we sort of talked about it. Atkinson is a showman. He's a bit of a pioneer and definitely that larger-than-life figure. And, Jamie, you were watching some incredible stuff on one of the kind of the big match revisited games, which is from something like 1978, I think. It's West Bromwich Crystal Palace. Before you get into the Ron Atkinson bot, by the way, and we will put a link into this so people can watch and see this themselves, but if you ever want to see two more beautiful kits than the Crystal Palace white, red and blue sash and West Bromwich Albion's yellow and green or gold and grey, I'm not sure the exact colours. Oh, that is a beautiful, two beautiful kits next to each other.
I love that West Brom away kit. I, as a kid, in my Panini collection, when I was able to get the players in their away shirt, which Panini would very rarely do, it was when you get like the double teams, It was always nice. It's such that, that yellow and golden green. But yeah, Graham, you're right. It's the 79-80 season. So it's the season after the one that we really probably want to get back to and focus on, because that's when West Brom are really pushing to win the league championship and come very, very close to a very good Liverpool team. But we already talked about the Liverpool game at Anfield when Brian Robson makes that incredible diving save. Before the game starts, Ron Atkinson is being interviewed literally as the players are warming up by Brian Moore, and he's giving tactics. He's like, yeah, we've decided to do something different today, Brian. We're going to put Robbo as a sweeper. We feel that, you know, with Terry McDermott running through the middle, it's really important that, you know, we've got someone like Robbo there. And then we've asked Peter Barnes to push up on Phil Neal. And it's just incredible to get that insight from a manager. I know you get the pre-match stuff now, but this is happening literally on as the game's about to kick off. But then the following week, they go to Crystal Palace away, as you've alluded to, and it gets even better because it's Crystal Palace at Selhurst Park in those beautiful kits that you've already described, Graham. It's goalless. And Brian Moore's just regularly commentating. There's the ball's gone out to Fenwick there. And anyway, Ron, how do you think your boys are doing? And the camera zooms into the bench and Ron Atkinson's got a microphone. He's holding his ear and then he's talking. I think in the birth of TV footballing cliches, because he's like, we need to be a bit tighter at the back. We need to be a bit tighter in the field. And we need to get the ball up to our forwards. And if we do that, we'll be all right. You know, we're causing them problems. We're going to get goals. And then at that point, I think Peter Barnes gets the ball and Ron Atkinson goes, and this fella needs to pull his finger out as well, because he needs to do it's absolutely fascinating. And why this has never caught on, you could probably understand why. But it's absolutely brilliant to get that level of insight whilst the football match is going on from the actual coach.
You're absolutely right about that. And then it cuts to Peter Barnes, doesn't it? And I think he said that Brian Moore says words to the effect, I think he might be getting a bit of a talking to at half time. Yeah. But no, as you say, absolutely brilliant. But Ron Atkinson, though, has always been an excellent communicator, always good value. You can see, again, why the players would rally to him, whichever team he managed. The journalists love him because he's engaging. He's got witty comments. I mean, I think he was a massive support to Willie Johnston, if you don't mind talking about Willie Johnston.
I never mind talking about Willie Johnston.
I mean, Willie Johnston, for me, it was my first real childhood hero. Absolutely loved Willie Johnston. I remember having a scarf, a West Bromwich Albion scarf, and he had on there his picture, and he said, Willie Johnston, faster than lightning. Because that's what they used to sing, he was faster than lightning. I've never known anyone so quick. He was born in Glasgow, and he was a miner. And when he joined Glasgow Rangers, he would go for training after being down the pit, and he would still be in his miner's boots. He was that quick that to give the others a chance in training in the sprints, he would run in his miner's boots. That's how quick he was. But what an entertainer. Probably his most famous game for Glasgow Rangers, the 1972 European Cup Winners' Cup final. And Rangers got to the final. It was played at the Nou Camp. And I'm not sure how you pronounce this. Is it Dynamo Moscow or Dynamo? Yeah. Dynamo Moscow. And Rangers won 3-2. And Willie Johnston scored two goals in that game. But that was his last game for Rangers. West Brom signed him. I think he'd look for a pay rise at Rangers. I think he was on probably after about £20 a week extra, which again sounds ridiculous now.
Yeah, yeah.
But Rangers wouldn't give it to him. So he came to the Albion, who probably trebled his wage, you see. Wonderful player. Will always be remembered, unfortunately, for the bad things. I think he was sent off about 22 times.
I assume you saw him sent off once or twice.
Yeah, many times. But of course, the players, the attacking players, the flair players, they had zero protection from the referees.
Yeah.
You're talking an era of, you know, Norman Bodge Your Legs Hunter, Ron Chopper Harris. So Willie Johnston used to say, I had to get my retaliation in first. Because very often when the players were lined up in the tunnel before the game, the defender was telling Willie Johnston what he was going to do to him in the game. But of course, his most infamous was, of course, the World Cup in Argentina. Yes. Because, again, you probably know this, guys, but what had happened was the year before that World Cup, 1978 in Argentina, Scotland had actually played in Argentina the year before in warm-up friendlies, again, just to see what the climate was like and all the rest of it. And Willie Johnston had been sent off then. And apparently the guy he'd been up against, the fullback, had said to him, Willie Johnson, don't come back to Argentina. And I think, you know, Willie Johnson, you know, perhaps we should listen to those words. Because going back to the World Cup in 1978, Scotland, at the end of the game, a couple of players were called in to be dope tested. I think Kenny Dalglish was one, and Archie Gemmell was the other. But Archie Gemmell apparently was that dehydrated, he couldn't give a urine sample. And my understanding is, in those days, the doping officials didn't go and select people. It was almost like a couple of volunteers. So I think Archie Gemmell went back in the dressing room and said to Willie, I can't, can you go? And Willie Johnson, yeah, no problem at all. And because he had nothing to hide.
Yeah.
And I think it was only later that evening, there was some official function going on. The Scotland players were all there in their blazers when a very young Trevor McDonald, a very rookie ITN news reporter in those days, approached Willie Johnson live on TV to say, what comments have you got to make about failing the drug test? That was the first Willie Johnson knew about it. Apparently, Willie Johnson suffered with hay fever, and I don't think he'd been feeding, you know, 100% just in the run-up to the game. And he took these over-the-counter tablets unawares. It was, it contained a banned substance, and all hell broke loose. But apparently, several of the Scottish players admitted that they'd taken exactly the same medication. And there, but for the grace of God, they could have easily been selected. But Sir Willie Johnson was sent home in disgrace. And when he arrived back at Heathrow Airport, lots of the tabloids were there. There's a car from West Bromwich Albion there waiting to pick him up, and Ron Atkinson. And Ron Atkinson grabs hold of Willie Johnson and says, don't worry, Willie, I've sorted it all out. I've got a new contract for you. And Willie Johnson said, what do you mean a new contract? He said, it's with Boots the Chemist. Ron Atkinson would make a joke about everything.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, he came back to such abuse from the tabloids and also the away supporters.
Yeah.
It made life hell for Willie Johnston.
A brilliant feature in these podcasts. I mean, Stefan, who covered the Scotland 78 team, went into some fun details about Willie Johnson as well, and probably the lack of protection that he had from Ali McLeod. But he's definitely going to feature again in these podcasts. So keep an ear out, Ian, because I think at some point, Graham and I are definitely going to cover one of our favourite topics, which is the North American Soccer League and Vancouver Whitecaps, where Willie Johnson also pulled a Mooney after scoring a goal to the Seattle coach. That's a feature on this podcast to look out for, a little kind of, you know, what's coming up in the next few months.
Yeah, I mean, just one thing occurs to me. When he was playing for West Brom, I don't know if you've heard this story, guys. He put him in one of the programmes, you know, they do like a little feature on the players. And he mentioned in that he had a passion for gardening. And I think he mentioned he was on the lookout for a new shed. And he's playing at the Hawthorns, and he's about to take a corner. And a fan says, I've got a garden shed for sale, Willie, if you're interested. And Willie Johnson said how much. He was quoted the price. Nah, too much. He took the corner. But apparently, the legend has it, over two or three games, he negotiated the price, and he ended up buying this shed off a supporter just from when he was taking corners.
Probably the most famous player, famous player for what he goes on to, and famous player for the transfer fee of that era, of course, and we haven't mentioned him yet other than his goalkeeping skills, is Brian Robson, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, what a wonderful footballer, Brian Robson. Of course, as West Bromwich Albion fans, we saw it very, very early. Funny enough, he had a couple of serious leg injuries with the Albion in his very early days. Broke his leg a couple of times, and I think he even broke his ankle in a comeback game. I think he was playing for the reserves against Stoke City reserves. And do you remember Denny Smith?
Oh, yes. Centre manager.
Of course, he managed West Brom.
And full manager, yeah.
But he was a no-nonsense player.
Yeah.
I think he fractured at least 16 of his own bones. I don't know, multiple bones. But accidentally, he broke the ankle of Brian Robson in his comeback game. But Brian Robson, unbelievable footballer. It's crazy to think now that when Ron Atkinson first saw Brian Robson playing for the Albion, he didn't rate him. He actually says, I wasn't convinced. What made him convinced about Brian Robson? We played Manchester United in the FA Cup at the Hawthorns. And due to injuries, he had to play Brian Robson. I think he was 19 at the time, centre half, marking Joe Jordan. And, you know, this would be Joe Jordan in his pomp, this game. And he just kept Joe Jordan quiet. And that's the game that turned Ron Atkinson into a huge Brian Robson fan. And the most complete Albion player I've ever seen by a distance. I don't think he had a weakness in his game. Tremendous energy. He wasn't super quick, but he seemed to have that energy to go the length of the pitch, find himself beyond players. I don't know where he found the energy from. Because, of course, in that era, the players weren't, they didn't have fitness coaches or the sports science people. I mean, you're going back to a time where there was, you know, there's a drinking culture, quite frankly. Do you know what I mean? And for him to be that fit, it makes you wonder what it'd be like in today's. And, of course, now Ron Atkinson always gets blamed for taking Brian Robson to Manchester United. But who could blame him? Whilst Ron Atkinson was still manager at the Albion, Brian Robson had asked him for a transfer because Brian Robson had made it into the England side.
Yeah.
And he knew that Manchester United wanted to buy him. Ron Atkinson was supposed to say to him, there's absolutely no way you're going to Man United. The only way you go to Man United is if I go there as manager. That's the only way. Now, when Ron Atkinson went to Man United as manager, Brian Robson is away on England duty. And apparently Ron Atkinson, the day he's appointed as Man United manager, gets a phone call from abroad from Brian Robson saying, Ron, you remember what we'd agreed? So it was always inevitable. I think that's where the Albion team started to fall away, because we had Laurie Cunningham go to Real Madrid. How can any player or any club stay in the way of Real Madrid?
Yeah.
Manchester United coming for Ron Atkinson. You're never really going to be able to. Again, people might not be familiar, but back in that time, that era, Manchester United were not only the biggest club in the UK, probably the biggest club in the world, weren't they? The most fashionable, the most glamorous.
Certainly not the best of that,
but
which was the oddity. I think Brian Robson wouldn't have gone to Manchester United had Ron Atkinson not go there. I think, Ian, you make a really valid point. I mean, Brian Robson was my footballing hero. I absolutely adored him and tried to model everything about playing football on him incredibly badly. But, you know, Liverpool were the top team at that particular moment by far and away. And, you know, it's an incredible Liverpool team in 78, 79 that is able to win the league and deny West Brom from winning a championship, which they came very close to. But, I mean, for all accounts at that particular period of time, Brian Robson should have been signing for Liverpool. But having Ron Atkinson go to Manchester United and having that relationship and that love for him, I think secured that deal. And it's quite interesting you talk about the drinking culture, because there is legacy to that. Because when Ferguson took over from Atkinson in 86, he spotted his drinking culture straight away. And he was like, right, I'm getting rid of this. So you probably remember Paul McGrath was
centre-back. Norman Whiteside.
And Brian Robson was very much gentle with that drinking culture. But not even Fergie had the balls to get rid of probably his best player at that particular moment. So he had something there that he had to protect. So he sent the message, but he didn't actually fulfil the full demands of getting rid of all of the chiefs in the drinking culture thing. But I have a question for Ian, because I've already mentioned, painful as it is, how brilliant that Liverpool team was in 79-78. They only conceded 16 goals. But Ian, do you think if the winter of discontent, that incredibly harsh winter, would not have been as harsh as it was, and West Brom's games wouldn't have built up? They're playing 9 games in April, 8 games in March. Do you think they would have been good enough to win the league that year?
That is a fabulous question. I'm biased, of course. I think we ended up finishing about 9 points behind Liverpool, if I remember rightly. Most Albion fans of my generation honestly believe that winter cost West Brom winning the league. I'm very divided on this. I think we'd have had we wouldn't have finished 9 points behind.
To help you out a little bit, they actually play 8 games in April, and they play 6 games in a 15-day period. I've never seen this before in the modern game, and I'm classing the 1970s as kind of the modern birth of the game. In these 6 games that they play in 15 days, they don't win any of them. So they're dropping points left, right and centre. They draw a lot of them. But they play Southampton on the 13th of April. And then on the 14th of April, they play Arsenal the day later.
You're absolutely right. 2 games in 2 days. Unbelievable. And I think both games finished 1-1 from memory.
You're right. Absolutely.
You know, it was an era where you would turn up to the game not knowing if it was going to be on. The pitch would be covered in snow. You'd be looking for volunteers to clear the pitch. We played one game, actually, on New Year's Day. There was one West Brom won 3-1 that day, but there was one incident that Bristol City got awarded a penalty. And as the player is about to come up to take the penalty, Ali Brown, one of the Albion players, threw a snowball at him. And but the player took the penalty and it went well wide of the post. The referee, though, spotted that the snowball had been thrown. So he ordered that the penalty kick be retaken, and Bristol City scored from it. But that was just how crazy it was. But yeah, I honestly think West Brom would have gone very, very close. In that December, Albion had such a good run. On Boxing Day, West Brom went and won at Highbury and won 2-1. And Ron Atkinson actually said that when Albion won at Boxing Day at Arsenal, we actually played better at Arsenal than they did a few days later when they won a 5-3 at Old Trafford. Just one very quick thing about the Old Trafford game, if I may. The goalkeeper that day for Manchester United was Gary Bailey. Remember Gary Bailey?
Well,
Tony Brown scored one of the goals that day in the 5-3 victory. That was in December 1978. Tony Brown made his debut back in 1963 for West Brom, away at Ipswich, and he scored that day. And the Ipswich goalkeeper was Roy Bailey, Gary Bailey's dad.
Wow.
So, you know, how crazy is that? And if, do you mind if I just very quickly talk about Ron Atkinson's second spell as manager at the Albion?
Yes, he
came back. Yeah, it's a very strange one. He came back to a very different West Bromwich Albion to the West Bromwich Albion that he left. It was a team struggling in the second tier and only just avoided relegation. But just like before, another club comes in for Ron Atkinson, Atletico Madrid. Now, again, you know, I speak to a lot of West Bromwich Albion fans who even to this day won't forgive Ron Atkinson for not just walking out on West Bromwich Albion once, but walking out twice. I always point out, well, to be fair, it was Manchester United and Atletico Madrid. But the Atletico Madrid one, I think, is interesting because he was only there for 96 days, I think it was.
Yeah, this is a common theme that we have on these things. So when he takes that job at Atletico Madrid, it comes during that weird period when English football teams are not competing in Europe because of the high school disaster. And you've got this exodus.
Yes.
Left the incredible Everton team to go managing in Spain to manage Valencia for a short time as well. And you've got players going off to different parts of the world. So I think Atkinson, although he was only there for, you know, he wasn't there for a great deal of time, there's a theme of English exports going to different parts of the world just so they can experience European football. And, you know, we haven't really touched on it. Ron Atkinson did take West Brom into European football on, I think, 3 occasions. Ian, correct me if I got that wrong.
Yes, yeah, you're absolutely right. In 78, 79. Because the previous season, we'd qualified for the UEFA Cup. And we played in the first round of the UEFA Cup, we played the Turkish side, Galatasaray, have I pronounced that correctly? And Albion went out there and Albion won 3-1. Toddy Cunningham scored twice. The return game at the Hawthorns, again, Albion won 3-1. So they won, obviously, 6-2 on aggregate. But the interesting thing about that return leg was the game was sponsored by Eric Clapton. Can you believe that? Eric Clapton, it's a bizarre one because Eric Clapton used to portray himself as a big West Bromwich Albion fan. I've always been a bit cynical myself. I've got here, West Bromwich Albion celebrated its centenary in 1979. And there's a booklet, 1879 to 1979. And there's a full-page advert in here from Eric Clapton.
In an amazing football
kit. And he says here, to 100 years of the best football ever played, congratulations, Ron, and he lists the players, and everyone connected with the club from their most devoted fan, Eric Clapton. There he is. As I say, he sponsored that game very bizarrely. And what he also did, he gave every member of the squad a gold disc. I think one of his albums was high-flying in the charts at the time. I can't remember if it was Slow Hand or was it 461, Ocean Boulevard. He had one or two albums. But funny enough, I bumped into Brendan Batten at a book signing a few months ago. And, you know, you got that awkward moment where you don't know what to say.
Yeah.
So I don't know where it came. I don't know where it came from. I randomly said to him, have you still got your gold disc from Eric Clapton? and he just looked at me you know, how on earth would I know that? But he took great delight in telling me, oh, yes, it's still got a pride of place on his wall. In the next round, we played Sporting Braga, the Portuguese team, obviously. And again, we won home and away, 2-0 away, 1-0 at home, 3-0 at aggregate. And in the programme for the Sporting Braga game, it does say, actually, I won't be able to put my fingers on it immediately, but it does say something to the effect that Eric Clapton is in the ground today, incognito. But of course, in those days, everyone dressed like he did. You know what I mean? With the beard and the long hair and the jeans. But then we played in the next round, Valencia. This was the crunch one.
Yeah, yeah.
And I briefly touched on it before when we drew 1-1 away. Lonnie Cunningham not only scored that day, but played absolutely magnificently. The return leg was at the Hawthorns. Albion won 2-0. Tony Brown scored both goals. In fact, Tony Brown has got a statue outside the Hawthorns. Mm. The only player to have his own a statue. He scored two goals in that game. One was a penalty. It recreates his non-penalty goal. Mm-hmm. So if ever you come to the Hawthorns and you see the pose,
yeah,
that's what it's.
That's the one.
It's Valencia goal. But that Valencia team, you know, they had a very good team. They had Bonhoff, the German.
Oh, of course.
And Mario Kempis. If you remember, he was top scorer in that 1978 World Cup final. So basically, the point I'm trying to make is Mario Kempis came to the Albion with Valencia, and they were sent packing. Then in the quarterfinals, I think it was, West Brom played Red Star Belgrade. Mm. First leg was away from home, played in front of 95,000 people. There was lots of trouble in the ground, by the way.
Mm.
Not with West Brom fans, because I wouldn't imagine too many West Brom fans travelled.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Red Star and Partizan Belgrade fans, rival fans were fighting. And I think there was gunshots fired as well.
Oh.
But that ended in 1-0 defeat on the night. Back at the Hawthorn, Cyril Regis had scored to put West Brom up. So it's 1-1 on aggregate. But right at the death, instead of settling for extra time, Albion were chasing the win. Red Star broke and scored a winning goal. They equalised on the night to go through 2-1. Absolutely devastating.
Before we'll get on to ranking the team, but before we do that we cannot leave this team and this era without mentioning Len Cantello's testimonial game, which is just an extraordinary thing, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. It's essentially black players versus white players. You know, it was billed as Cyril Regis 11, was it?
Yes, yeah.
But that's essentially what it was. But at the time, it sounds crazy now.
Mm.
But at the time, I don't think there was any anything sinister about it or anything political or racial. Or it just came about. In fact, I've tried to find out how it originated. No one seems to know. But, yeah, very, very strange. But also, of course, testimonials were fairly common in those days because you had players staying with their club for a long time. Mm. I mean, for example, the guys who hold the league appearance record for playing the most number of games for Albion came from that era. Tony Brown, Alistair Robertson and John Wyle.
Yeah.
There have been lots of testimonials. You can only play the Wolves so many times or play the Villa so many times before you've got to, you know, venture forward. So I think this is how this came about. Yeah. But looking back now, it sounds crazy. And, of course, it wouldn't be allowed these days. But I certainly think the black players were determined to win. I remember certainly Garth Crooks was very, very determined. There'd be other players, I'm trying to remember now, Bob Hazel.
Remy Moses. Obviously went to United.
Moses, of course, yes.
Yes, Remy Moses, of course, yeah. As you rightly say, yeah. Yeah, funny enough, he actually went to Manchester United before Brian Robson. And I think the combined fee for the two, Albion received in those days, £2 million.
Mm.
Remy Moses is an interesting character because have you ever seen anything about Remy Moses? Have you ever seen him interviewed?
No.
Because I haven't.
No, you're
very
right.
Private. Testimonials. I mean, Tony Brown had two testimonials at the Albion because he was there 18 years. Can you believe that?
Yeah. Yeah, crazy, isn't it?
And we mentioned Jack, even crazier. You know, we mentioned Jack Taylor earlier.
Mm.
Jack Taylor had a testimonial. How crazy is that? I swear.
22 referees.
I think it was
decisions.
Yeah. I mean, how many referees have been awarded a testimonial? He was. It was played at Villa Park, and I think there was about 6,800 or something like that. It was like a Midlands 11 versus an England 11.
Sometimes in testimonials, they will kind of, you know, let the guy who's, especially if he's sort of carrying an injury and is sort of in the twilight of his career, they sometimes let the guy whose testimonials get a winning penalty. I wonder if they let Jack Taylor send someone off.
Brilliant.
We better get to ranking this incredible West Bromwich Albion side. We have five categories of greatness. All-time greats right at the top, followed by true greats. Touch of greatness, edge of greatness, and blinker great. We won't need blinker greats for this side, definitely. Jamie, let me start with you. How great is this West Bromwich Albion side?
Yeah, I've been dreading this. I came to this before we started recording, looking at how we've ranked the 50 teams previously. Because what one thing we can't run away from, as painful as it is that unfortunately the greatness isn't what they've won. It's the greatness is what they've done, which is a very important question. So I just looked at how we've ranked teams in the past. And in the top two brackets, all time and true, there's no team that actually we've ranked previously that hasn't won anything. So already I'm kind of struggling with where my head's going to be on that. But in the touch of greatness, which is our third tier, you have a Hereford United that didn't win anything but got elected to the Easter Football League, and you've got a Sheffield FC. They're in there because they're the oldest football team, and they had a boys' jolly down to Battersea to have a game of football. And along with a lot in the touch of greatness bracket, Ali McLeod, Scotland from 78. So I think it's important in this particular team to really understand the context of what they achieved on the pitch. They were exciting to watch, and Ian's already alluded to, you know, how brilliant they were to watch. They excited Ron Atkinson, who's an absolute charismatic, brilliant figure. And I think Ron Atkinson has been quoted when asked, you know, who's the best team he's ever managed. And, you know, he's won FA Cups for Man United, League Cups for Sheffield Wednesday and Aston Villa. You know, he's firmly always gone back to West Brom. That was his sweet spot. So I think we shouldn't really, we've covered it, but we shouldn't forget the trailblazer with black players. I mean, West Brom opened the door. They weren't the first team to play three black players at the same time. West Ham did that in 1972, but West Brom were definitely the first team to do it on a consistent, regular basis, and with three exceptionally talented players. I mean, Laurie Cunningham, who we've mentioned, was the first British player that Real Madrid signed. I mean, that is something of some serious stature to actually make that as a statement. So I agree with you. They're not blinkered greats. That would just be far too damning because there's so much going on. So then if I've ruled out all time and true, I'm kind of thinking we're into touch or edge. This is not an edge of greatness for me. This is an absolute priceless story. So I'm going to kick us off by putting them in the middle bracket, and that is touch of greatness.
Ian, are you going higher?
I think what Jamie said is extremely fair, and I'm trying to be take off my navy blue and white glasses. I think I would incline to agree with Jamie, if I'm being really as fair as I can be. I think that was an excellent summary.
I have to say, I think I'm inclined to agree with Jamie. What they are is this is an unbelievably exciting team. It's a pioneering team. When I think back at the side, they actually overperformed how I remembered them. I didn't remember them running so close to actually winning the league. I'd kind of, in my mind, I just sort of thought, they played some great football. I had forgotten just how many players that they had. The point you make, Ian, actually, I think the way Ron Atkinson kind of blends this team of club stalwarts and legends that you have, you know, Robertson, Brown, Wild, these guys have been there for absolute ages. But they've got this young breed of players coming, and they're exciting players. We didn't talk very much about Peter Barnes, who was someone, you had Willie Johnston there. And Atkinson's side's always had these entertainers, and he is about entertainment. West Brom were about entertainment, and for that reason, I have to go there. So Ron Atkinson's West Bromwich Albion, 78-81, touch of greatness.
I think it would be a remiss of us not to bring up the Time Machine, which we haven't used for a while. Not for you and I, but for Ian, I think. It would just, I think, to indulge in just listening to where Ian would go back in time if he had that one chance in the Time Machine. I think it would be bad manners of us not to ask him.
Yeah, so Ian, if there was one game you could go back to during that era, or go to that you didn't go to, where would you want to be?
It'd probably be that Old Trafford game, December 1978, where West Brom won 5-3. That was the day West Bromwich Albion, I think, showed the nation. I think at the time, we were a lot of people's second favourite team. And Manchester United weren't the force that they became then by any stretch. But they were still a very, very good side. And I remember, again, the Man United fans applauding West Bromwich Albion that day. Mm. I think, if I remember right, it's funny how your mind can play tricks on you over the years. But I think West Brom were losing 2-1. And just on the stroke of half-time, Tony Brown's equalised. And in the dressing room at half-time, Ron Atkinson, he's having a go at the players. He says, you know, you shouldn't be losing this 2-1. You shouldn't be losing. You know, we can win this game. And I said, but Gaffer, it's 2-2. I told you shouldn't be losing. He hadn't realised, because I think he'd gone into the tunnel, into the dressing room early. And he says, I told you we shouldn't be losing. But it was just, I think in those days, the players would go out and the supporters expecting to win with no fear. But, you know, just, yeah, wonderful, wonderful footballers. Great memories. I say I was spoiled at the time. I was incredibly naive. I wasn't political at all. I was just a teenager, just in my last year at school kind of thing. Wasn't interested in the politics. There was the winter of discontent, as Jamie's mentioned. You had James Callaghan as Prime Minister. Margaret Thatcher was going to take over in the May 79. You had the dustmen on strike. The rubbish wasn't being collected. The grave diggers were on strike. The hauliers were on strike. But as a kid, it was all over my head. Do you know what I mean? I was interested in the music. I was interested in going to see West Brom play. Happy times. And it's funny, I can remember those days far more clearly than I can more recent seasons, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I think I had a very strong bond, strong affinity. Yeah, great times. If there was a particular game, it would be that one. It just sounds great to even say it now. Manchester United 3, West Bromwich Albion 5.
It's too good. It's too good. Definitely so. Ian, thanks so much for sharing some of your memories and stories of it. It's been
absolutely
fantastic. It's been a real pleasure. Jamie, thanks for your help as ever.
It's been a pleasure, Ian. Honestly, thank you. I'm so grateful for you coming on and sharing your stories about West Brom. I loved it.
That's very kind of you. And thanks very much for indulging my two favourite subjects, football in general and West Bromwich Albion Football Club in particular. Thanks ever so much, guys.
It's been brilliant. As a quick reminder, you can listen to any of our podcasts. They'll be coming out every week. They come out on a Thursday. So do subscribe to us to get them directly into your podcast feed, however you take it. And a quick pointer to our new updated website. Jamie, what's the domain name?
TheGreatestTeam.co.
And on that one, you can find details of all our rankings, all the teams we've ever done, and a few promos of the teams that are coming up very soon. Next up, almost certainly, if everything goes according to plan, we're going to Roy Hodgson's Fulham.